and slacking on homework, when they continue to love you but set your curfew earlier as a consequence of thoughtlessly breaking it, all of these parental actions and responses are internalized by you, the child. You not only internalize the ability to make yourself do things to stop yourself from doing things, you internalize your parental voices, which later in adulthood become your own. The internalized parental voice is extremely important, and it can often go awry in emotional neglect. Let's take the example of William from our self-discipline section of Chapter 3. William's busy, single mother loved him dearly. She let him run relatively free throughout his childhood, with little responsibility at home and low accountability at school. William was an intelligent, likable, even charming boy, and everyone wanted the best for him. His teachers cut him slack because they could see that he was bright and capable. William would later report a fun, free childhood and be perplexed by his adult struggles with being productive and confident. His wife was confused by his difficulty regulating his eating, sleeping, and work hours. She was puzzled by his erratic tendencies, such as working into the wee hours of the morning, sleeping a few hours, skipping meals, then going to bed at 7 p.m. the next night. But William's productivity suffered, not just because of his erratic schedule. It was also compromised by a harsh voice in his head when he was working, which frequently told him that what he produced wasn't good enough, wasn't done quickly enough, or would be a disappointment to his boss. William spent so much time and energy battling this harsh, critical voice in his head that he had little left over to produce much of anything. You may be wondering where William got this harsh inner voice. After all, his mother was not harsh with him. She didn't judge him or give him negative feedback or expect too much from him. The problem was that in the absence of a parental voice, William had to make up his own. He not only had a shortage of skills for structuring himself so that he could be productive, he had no idea what he could expect of himself or how to judge the quality of his productions. The voice he invented for himself was not a balanced, moderate, and loving adult voice. His inner voice went back and forth between harsh judgments and complete indulgences. This is why his wife was puzzled by his erratic sleep hours, eating habits, and work schedule. William's inner self-regulating voice was erratic, both harsh and indulgent. Some emotionally neglected people's self-created voices are more predictable, meaning they are only one or the other. Still, other emotionally neglected people actually manage to figure out self-regulation for themselves and create a voice for themselves that's mature, measured, caring, and firm. If you are in this last category, you can give yourself all the credit for a job well done. If you're in one of those previous categories, do not despair. You can change your self-discipline voice. As an adult, you can re-parent yourself in this area by basically rewiring your own brain. You can do it by using a simple but effective rewiring program I call the Three Things Program. In this skill-building exercise, you will be wiring your brain with the hardware that's essential to have in order to be able to make yourself do what you don't want to do, and vice versa. It works like this. Every day, you must do three things that you don't want to do, or stop yourself from doing three things you want to do but shouldn't. Every day, you record the three things in your, you guessed it, self-discipline change sheet. Visit my website, www.drjanicewebb.com, to access this and other change sheets. To help you get a feel for this, I'll give you some examples of three things that my patients have done and shared with me. They are face washing, bill paying, exercise, floor sweeping, shoe tying, phone calling, dishwashing, and task starting. on the things you stop yourself from doing side, not eating a piece of chocolate devil's food cake, not buying a pretty necklace online, not having that one more drink when out with friends, and not skipping class. Keep in mind that the point here is not to deprive yourself of enjoyment. If chocolate cake isn't a problem for you, then that may not be the impulse to override. Try to choose urges that are negative for you in some way. As you can see, it doesn't matter how big or small the thing is. It's not the thing that's done or not done that really matters in this exercise. It's the action of overriding your default setting. It's a bit like the George Costanza experiment, in that you're forging new neural pathways in your brain by forcing yourself to do something that's not supported by the current neural connections. Try to do this program regularly. If you slip, start right back up again without being too self-critical and without being too self-indulgent by letting yourself off the hook. If you keep at it, you'll notice that it will become easier and easier for you to self-regulate, manage your impulses, and complete unrewarding but necessary tasks. It will build and grow and eventually become an active, hardwired part of who you are. Self-care Part 3. Self-soothing. No matter how good you get at the IAAA rules, identify, accept, attribute, act, for managing your emotions, you will undoubtedly have times in your life when you will be emotionally uncomfortable. As you know from having lived thus far, life hands us all kinds of experiences, and in response to those experiences, we have all kinds of emotions, some wonderful, some neutral, and some unpleasant. IAAA will certainly help at those times. But what do you do when the feeling is persistent or difficult to manage? This is where self-soothing comes in. As an emotionally neglected person, chances are good that you haven't put much thought into the concept of self-soothing. Self-soothing is another life skill that non-neglected children learn from their parents. When a father rubs his fitful son's back to help him fall asleep after a nightmare, when a mother holds her crying child and smooths his forehead, when a father listens carefully to his daughter's long story about something unfair that happened to her at school that day, when a mother sits with calm, quiet empathy through her son's tantrum, these emotionally present parents are teaching this vital life skill to their children. Children whose emotions are accepted, tolerated, and appropriately soothed internalize their parents' ability to do so. Children absorb the self-soothing skill like the little sponges that they are, and it's a skill that they'll need to have throughout their entire lives. You probably didn't grow up completely devoid of all soothing from your parents. Again, it comes down to whether you received enough. Many emotionally neglected people as adults are improvising in this area. Just as no two people are exactly the same, no two people are soothed the exact same way. Everyone's needs are different. Throughout my career as a psychologist, I've helped people identify a seemingly infinite number of different self-soothing techniques. The worst time to try to figure out what works for you is when you need it the most. It will work very much to your advantage to identify good possible strategies and have them ready to try when you do need them. It's likely that a self-soothing strategy that works in one situation may not work in another, and vice versa. So it's good to have not just one strategy, but a list of them. That way, in your moment of need, you can try one, and if that doesn't work, try another. In order to identify effective soothers, it may help to think back to your childhood. Were there things that you found comforting as a child? Also, think back to the most emotionally challenging times of your adulthood. Have there been helpful self-soothing strategies that you've used in the past without realizing it? One warning is to be careful what types of strategies you use. Make sure they're healthy for you. Alcohol, shopping, and eating can help in moderation, but if they're overused, they can make your problem bigger later, or they can end up giving you another problem to deal with. The following are some examples of healthy, self-soothing strategies that have been identified and used effectively by others. Try these and/or use them as a starting point to help identify what works for you and make your own list. Bubble bath. Long hot shower. Listen to music, maybe a particular song. Polish your car. Exercise. Run, lift weights, take a bike ride. Play guitar or other instrument. Cook or bake. We're talking about the process here. Be careful not to overuse food itself for self-soothing. Spend time with your pet. Play with a child. Go for a walk. A smell that you found comforting in childhood. Call a friend. Lie on the ground and watch the clouds or look at the stars. Clean. Go to the movies. Sit quietly and look out the window. Sit in a church and meditate. Self-talk. Self-talk is probably the most useful and versatile of all self-soothing strategies. It involves literally talking yourself through your uncomfortable feeling state. You can do it quietly, on your own, within your own mind, so you can do it in public, in a meeting, or on a train. Remind yourself of simple, honest truths which will help you keep things in perspective. Here are some examples of things you can say to yourself. It's only a feeling, and feelings don't last forever. You know you're a good person. You know you meant well. You tried your best, and it didn't work out. Just wait it out. This will pass. I need to figure out what I can learn from this, and then put it behind me. The possibilities are endless and must be determined by the situation and by what you're feeling. This self-soothing strategy works for most people. It is definitely worth adding to your repertoire. Use the self-soothing change sheet found on my website to make your list. Be sure to keep your list flexible. Scratch off ones that stop working for you and add new ones as needed. Make self-soothing a meaningful, purposeful endeavor that grows and changes with you. All of your life, you will need to have the ability to soothe yourself. As you get better at it, you'll find yourself a calmer person who feels more in control and more comfortable overall. Self-care, Part 4. Having compassion for yourself. You may be either disappointed or relieved to learn that there will be no change sheet to help you build your self-compassion. That's because this aspect of self-care is actually more of a feeling and a philosophy than a skill. It will be much more difficult to build it by changing your behavior, or, in other words, from the outside in. It is best developed from the inside out. That said, I did save self-compassion for last for a reason. It's a higher order aspect of self-care. If all of the components of self-care were put into pyramid form, self-compassion would be at the top. It rests upon all of the self-care skills you've been working on. It requires a level of self-love and kindness that can only come when you care enough to treat yourself well. Why is self-compassion so important? If you have a lack of compassion for yourself, you're more likely to castigate yourself with a ruthless internal voice for your own honest mistakes and errors, like Noel and William did in Chapter 3. You may go so far as blaming yourself and being angry with yourself for having normal feelings and issues, like Laura in Chapter 3. Or you could even end up feeling worthless and empty to the point of considering suicide, like Robin in Chapter 4. No matter how you slice it, judging, blaming, disliking, insulting, and wanting to kill yourself are all the opposites of self-care. Chances are you wouldn't treat anyone else this way, so why do you treat yourself this way? All of these are self-destructive and will exhaust your energy reserves and take you nowhere but down. Remember that compassion, along with empathy, is one of the highest forms of human emotion. It's healing, soothing, and unifying. It pulls people together and holds them in a positive and compelling way. The compassion you have for others is a part of the positive effect you have on the people and the world around you. It's time that you yourself receive some of the benefits of that. Here are 5 guiding principles to help you in your quest to increase your self-compassion. Self-compassion, Principle 1. The Golden Rule in Reverse. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you is the Golden Rule. The Golden Rule for the emotionally neglected is the same rule, but in reverse. Do unto yourself as you would do unto others. In other words, don't let your critical voice say anything to you that you wouldn't say to someone you care about. Don't punish yourself in a way that you wouldn't punish someone you care about. If you wouldn't punish a friend for doing something, don't punish yourself for it either. Do you think that if your friend ran over a curb while parallel parking, you would say to her, "You idiot! What a lousy driver! You're an embarrassment!" No, you would not. You should therefore not speak to yourself that way. If you find yourself unable to silence your harsh, critical voice, I highly recommend the book Self-Esteem by McKay and Fanning. Self-Compassion, Principle 2. Become aware of damaging self-directed anger. Anger at yourself is the opposite of compassion. Start trying to notice how often and how intensely you feel angry with yourself. This is important because there is a point at which self-directed anger becomes unhelpful. It starts to make you dislike yourself as a person, and that's self-destructive. If you make a mistake, there's only one thing you can do, and that's learn from it. Anything else is wasted energy. Anytime you feel angry with yourself, consider it a cue to turn the compassion you have for others upon yourself. Self-compassion, Principle 3. Give yourself the benefit of your own wisdom and compassion. As an emotionally neglected person, you're probably a great listener. And like Robin from Chapter 4, your friends talk to you because you give them helpful advice. You're non-judgmental, caring, and compassionate to others. That's a breeze for you. Your job now is becoming able to use your own voice of non-judgmental wisdom to help yourself the same way that you use it to help others. That means being able to speak your wisdom to yourself and being able to listen and take in your own voice. Why should others get the benefit of your help and caring, but not you? Self-compassion, Principle 4. Develop an inner, loving, but firm voice. As an emotionally neglected person, you didn't get the advantage of internalizing a loving but firm voice from your parents. While other kids' parents were saying, "It's okay, let's figure out what to do so that you'll do better next time," you were scrambling for yourself. You were, in the absence of helpful parental input, saying to yourself either the too harsh, "You idiot," or the letting yourself off the hook, I'm not going to think about this. With the former, you're feeding self-anger and draining off your energy. With the latter, you're setting yourself up to make the same mistake again. Either way, you lose. A helpful, positive, loving but firm voice will seem like a dialogue, in that you are questioning yourself, making yourself think, in a non-judgmental way, about what went wrong and how to prevent it from happening again in the future. Here's an example of what your voice might say to you if you forgot to fill up the car and ran out of gas on the freeway on the way home from work. How did this happen? You were going to stop and fill up after running errands at lunch today. Well, let's see. Why didn't I stop and fill up after lunch today? Oh, yes, I was running late. I barely made it back for my 1 o'clock meeting because there was such a huge line at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Those were really circumstances out of my control. How can I make sure this doesn't happen again? Never plan gas fill up for lunchtime. There's not enough flexibility in that 1 hour to make sure it will be done. From now on, I'll make sure I gas up either during the morning driving to work or on my way home, so I won't be set up to forget again. Notice how this loving but firm voice isn't too easy on you, but neither is it self-destructively tough. The voice takes 4 key steps. It, 1, holds you accountable for your mistake without jumping to judgment or blame. 2, helps you think through which part of the mistake is your fault and what part is due to other people or circumstances. 3, determines what to do differently to prevent this error from happening again in the future. 4, helps you realize that you've learned something important from this mistake and lets you put it behind you. These steps are all productive and useful. They're the means to an end. They will help make your life better without doing damage to your self-esteem or your self-confidence. All of life is about learning, growing, and becoming better. These 3 steps will do all of those things for you. Keep working on creating that loving but firm parental voice. Self-Compassion Principle 5. Allow yourself to be human. Like having feelings, making mistakes is an essential part of being human. Both are non-negotiable conditions of humanity. Please know that there's not a human being on earth who hasn't had many, many feelings and made many, many mistakes. If you meet people who say otherwise, don't listen to them. They're full of nonsense, to put it kindly. No doubt working on all of these skills must seem a bit daunting. Having lived a childhood devoid of some of the most important components of emotional health and self-care leaves you with no choice but to re-parent yourself in your adulthood. My solemn promise to you is that if you do this work of building yourself up, brick by brick, skill by skill, step by step, you'll reap the tremendous rewards. As you build up the pyramid of self-love, you'll be climbing it too, until you reach the top and find that you have a level of kindness and calmness within yourself and for yourself that you never knew existed. And when you turn your powerful compassion upon yourself, you'll be living with a new you, a you that's lovable, fallible, imperfect, with strengths and weaknesses, wins and losses, sensitivity and resilience, a full and connected you. Chapter 8. Ending the Cycle. Giving Your Child What You Never Got. If you were emotionally neglected and are a parent or want to be one someday, it's very important that you listen to this chapter carefully. The first thing we'll address here is your own parental guilt. Second, together, we'll identify the areas in which your emotional neglect challenges appear or may appear in your future as a parent. Finally, we'll talk about what you can do to make sure that you will be an emotionally attuned parent who raises children who are emotionally aware and attuned to themselves and others. But before any of that, let's start with the good news. Take heart that no matter what mistakes we've made as parents, they can be fixed. Children are incredibly resilient. As I've said before, children are like little sponges. They soak up whatever we give them. And the converse is also true. They don't soak up what we don't give them. So as soon as we change what we're giving them, they'll change, often after an adjustment period. Beyond that, any changes you make in yourself will trickle down to your children. The more you change yourself for the positive, the more your children will naturally change for the positive. This is true even for teenagers, although teens can be somewhat different because they'll often do their best to hide those changes from you, their parents. Don't be fooled. Your teen is changing too. 1. Your parental guilt. Here's my first question for you. Has listening to this book made you doubt or feel guilty about your parenting? Has it set off that self-blame and ruthless self-judgment that's so typical of the emotionally neglected? If so, the 5 principles that you will hear about in a moment should help. As you continue through the chapter, be sure to return to these 5 principles and listen to them again as needed to address any guilt that may arise for you. This will require you to be emotionally attuned to yourself so that you'll notice when you feel guilty, and emotionally caring for yourself so that you'll take the time to come back and listen to them again. Many parents have some degree of guilt about their parenting at times. It often arises out of concern about whether you are doing the job right. But guilt is not necessary for good parenting, and it can actually interfere with healthy parenting. If you're a guilt-prone parent, your guilt may be interfering with your ability to make good parenting decisions. It's hard to say no when you feel guilty. It's harder to set limits with your children. It can make you second-guess your every move. Children pick up on parental self-doubt and know how to take advantage of it. Therefore, guilt weakens you as a figure of authority. While guilt may be a sign that you care, you will probably be a better parent without it. Instead of feeling guilty, the goal is to hold yourself accountable as a parent, but also understand that no parent is perfect. All parents make mistakes, including at least a few big ones. Try to follow the same rules for parenting that you follow for self-discipline. If you're harsh on yourself for your parenting mistakes, you're sapping your own energy and rendering yourself weak and ineffective. Holding yourself responsible is not the same thing as kicking yourself. Like everyone else, you've been parenting according to what you've known and experienced yourself. You haven't been able to offer your own children the emotional strengths that you didn't have yourself. The fact that you're listening to this book and this particular chapter means that you care and that you're ready and strong enough to change. You already have a great advantage over your own parents. 2. The changes you have made so far. Perhaps you've already been making some changes in yourself as you've been listening to this book. If you have, then your children already may have had some reactions to those changes. Are you saying no more often? Are you more often putting yourself first? Are you making your own enjoyment a higher priority? These are all healthy changes for you that will also have positive effects for your children. Unfortunately, they may not realize that quite yet. Children just react when they don't get what they want. But that doesn't mean that it's bad that they didn't get what they wanted. They'll benefit greatly from seeing you value yourself and your own needs. It will enable them to grow up valuing themselves and their own needs. Your child will need help adjusting to the changes you've made, and you will need to combat the effects of emotional neglect that may have trickled down from you to them. If you see your child reacting to the changes you've made, try not to react to her reaction. Instead, dive underneath her behavior by asking yourself, what is she feeling right now? Then gently feed it back to her like this. I know you're not used to me saying no about this, honey. I'm sorry. I know it must be hard for you when I start making different decisions. This will not stop her from being upset about your saying no, but you'll be amazed at how much it helps when you simply validate her feelings. More about this later. 3. Identify your own specific parenting challenges. The best way to know how your emotional neglect is affecting your children is to go back to look at how it's affected you. Whatever holes or gaps you have in your emotional health will be the same holes or gaps that your children will be more likely to have, unless you fill them. Let's look again at the list of adult characteristics that emotionally neglected people are often left with. Think back to Chapter 3. Which of these characteristics did you identify with? 1. Feelings of emptiness. 2. Counterdependence. 3. Unrealistic self-appraisal. 4. No compassion for self, plenty for others. 5. Self-directed anger, self-blame. 6. Guilt and shame. What is wrong with me? 7. Fatal flaw. If people really know me, they won't like me. 8. Difficulty nurturing self and others. 9. Poor self-discipline. 10. Alexithymia. Poor awareness and understanding of emotions. If you're not sure about a particular characteristic, please review Chapter 3. Don't overthink it. Listen to your gut. This is not about what you think. It's about what you feel. Ask yourself if you feel that this particular issue applies to you. You must trust your feelings on this, and that will have an added bonus of being good practice for you in learning to trust your feelings more in general. Now that you've identified the adult characteristics of your emotional neglect, let's talk about how each of these plays out in the context of parenting. 1. Emptiness versus filled with premium grade. Empty feelings arise from not having been filled up emotionally as a child. Something was missing in your connection with your parents, a fullness in the quality and or quantity of emotional connection as a child. Let's think of the quality of your family's emotional connection as a fuel grade. A child who grows up with enough regular octane or above will probably not have a problem with emptiness as an adult. If you received lower grade fuel as a child and you are experiencing emptiness as an adult, there's a good chance that you may not be providing your own children with enough high-octane fuel. If this rings a bell for you, it's very important to realize that this is not your fault. You can't give your child what you don't have yourself. Also, it's important that you know there is a solution to this dilemma. It's not a simple formula, it's not a checklist, and it has nothing to do with changing your behavior. In fact, the only way to give your child what you don't have yourself is to provide yourself with what you don't have. Only then can your child benefit. Here's how it works. As you work on all of the exercises presented in Chapter 6, designed to teach you to value your emotions, you will become a more connected, expressive, and richly aware human being. As you go through the Chapter 7 change process, you'll be increasing the octane level of your own tank. The richer your own fuel becomes, the richer the fuel you'll be filling your children with. The more you care about yourself, love yourself, understand yourself, and value your emotional self, the more you'll care, love, understand, and value your children and their emotions. Gradually, you'll have less empty feelings, and gradually, your children will become less prone to emptiness. Their tanks will be filled with rich, long-burning, premium-grade love for self and others that will keep them going for their entire lives. 2. Counterdependence versus mutually interdependent. If you have this adult characteristic, it means that at some point you received a message from your parents that it's not acceptable for you to depend upon or need other people. Your own parents' lack of attention to, lack of tolerance for, or failure to fulfill your emotional needs sent you a clear message that you'd better be fiercely independent. You'd better avoid needing attention or help. You'd better provide for yourself. Now take a moment to ponder this question. Can you think of any ways in which you might be giving this message to your own children as you raise them? Given that you've grown up valuing fierce independence, it would make sense that you'd value teaching your children to be this way. Or maybe you haven't thought about it at all, and you just automatically do what you know, as all parents naturally tend to do. Either way, you're setting your children up to miss out on the great advantages of being mutually interdependent with their fellow human beings. What the heck is mutual interdependence, you might say? Mutual interdependence is the ideal balance for relationships between adults, be they marriage or friendship. I am excluding parent-child relationships because a tremendous amount of dependency is naturally built into the parent-child relationship. Mutual interdependence means that both parties in the relationship are capable of a healthy level of independence and self-reliance, but each member of the relationship relies on the other for some things and at some times. Each person is maximized in their potential to care for themselves, but maximized even further by the addition of what the other person has to offer. If you give your children the message that they are not to depend on others, you are depriving them of the valuable strengths which the other people in their lives can bring them. These strengths could be any way in which another person enriches or enlivens us or lessens our burden. Just a few simple examples from the vast sea of possibilities might be comforting words and a soothing touch, help moving furniture, or a well-cooked meal. There must be a balance in our lives that allows us to give and take, love and be loved, care and be cared for. It's mutual interdependence, and you and your children deserve to have it. As a parent, how do you raise your children with this kind of balance that doesn't come naturally to you? The reality is, it's not easy. The good news is that the changes you make in your own counterdependence will trickle down to your children. The less afraid you become to rely on others, the less afraid your children will be to rely on others. But here's the most important aspect of that. The more you're there for your children when they need you, the more mutually interdependent they will be. Don't be afraid of making them too dependent. The only way to do that is to help them too often, in too many ways, when they don't need help. In order to be there for your children when they need you, but not overdo it, you must be in tune with your child. Remember third grade Zeke's sociopathic mom who sent him to his room to write, "I will never get in trouble at school again," 50 times in cursive. She was an extreme example of a parent who's out of tune with her child's capabilities. A mother who has such a skewed view of what her child can and cannot do developmentally will be a poor judge of when to step in to help her child. So to be able to distinguish correctly when you should provide your child with help, it will help to follow the example that was given in Chapter 1, Healthy versus Emotionally Neglectful Parenting, which also used third-grade Zeke. You must feel an emotional connection to your child so that you'll know when it's time to step in and soothe and help him. You must pay attention to your child to give you a good idea of what he truly can and can't do, so you'll know when he genuinely needs help. You must respond competently, which means providing him with meaningful and appropriate help. No parent is perfect at all of these steps. All you can do is try your best. If you do, your children will love and appreciate you in a different way, because they'll feel that you understand them and that they have support and help when they need it. They'll be more willing to reach higher, have richer relationships, and better fulfill their own potential. They'll be both independent and able to take in help from others. They'll feel less alone in the world throughout their entire lives. 3. Unrealistic self-appraisal versus strong, clear sense of self. This adult characteristic basically comes down to not really knowing who you are. Remember how we talked about children learning about themselves by seeing themselves reflected in their parents' eyes? That reflection is hard to catch when your parents aren't looking at you much. If you, as an adult, have a view of yourself that's not clear or not based in reality, it probably means that your parents didn't do well enough at paying attention to you. This may mean that they didn't spend enough time with you, but not necessarily. A parent can be with their child 24/7, not that that would be healthy, and still not be seeing his child. Paying attention in this case doesn't mean pouring juice as needed, and it doesn't refer to the artful placement of a pretty hair barrette. It means noticing your child's natural likes and dislikes and strengths and weaknesses, remembering them, and feeding them back helpfully to the child. This is how a child internalizes a realistic sense of who she is. One of the change sheets was on likes and dislikes. This sheet was designed to help you become more aware of the things you innately enjoy and don't enjoy. Likes and dislikes feed into self-appraisal, as do abilities, appearance, personality traits, intellect, social skills and preferences, habits, and the almost endless factors that make up who you are. The process you use to learn your likes and dislikes can also be used to learn more about the complexities of who you are. And that process also applies to your parenting. As you parent your children, it's important that every day you pay attention and that every day you give them helpful feedback. This doesn't mean being overly critical or negative, because that can be damaging to their self-esteem. But if you see your son excelling at football far more than baseball, you can say, for example, "You are a football machine." You should not say that to him about baseball if it isn't true. But you shouldn't say, "You're not good at baseball," because that's too negative and could be damaging. Reflect back to your child the academic skills with which she naturally excels. Reflect back the skill with which she tends to struggle. For instance, "We need to spend more time on math." If your child seems to have little talent on the violin but loves to play it, point out to him that you admire his love of music and his willingness to work hard to master something. Avoid giving feedback that's too harsh or might hurt your child's feelings. Avoid giving feedback that's not realistic. Be honest and loving, caring and clear. Sometimes you have to just be there, observe, and say nothing. Your child will absorb your watchfulness and will see his own reflection. During the 18-plus years that you're raising him, he'll look into his parental mirror again and again. He'll see this piece of himself and that piece of himself. He'll see the pieces grow, change, and develop. The pieces will coalesce into an accurate reflection of a full and complete person, and that person will know what he wants and what he's capable of. He will be starting his adult life with a tremendous advantage that you didn't have, a full, clear, and strong picture of who he is. That is a gift only you could give him. 4. No compassion for self versus compassion. As a parent, you do not want your children to grow up treating themselves harshly, kicking themselves for their own mistakes. You want your child to learn from his mistakes, to keep growing and loving himself. It's your job to teach your child compassion for others and for himself. To do this, you can apply the same 4 self-compassion principles that we talked about in Chapter 7. If you have compassion for your children, they will have it for themselves and others. Remember that the first compassion principle is the reverse golden rule. Here's how it applies to parenthood. Do unto your child as you wish your parents had done unto you. A parent who grew up emotionally neglected cannot follow her default settings for parenting. Since her default settings were determined by her primary caregivers, those settings will likely result in her passing down her own emotional neglect to her child. As a parent, it's vital to work hard to override your own settings and create healthier ones for your child. So when your child makes a bad decision, screws up, does something thoughtless or wrong, it will be important for you to do your best not to react immediately. Impulsive, emotional reactions will be determined by your default settings. Instead, take a moment and think, if I were my child, what would I need from my parent right now so that I can learn from this and move on? The second self-compassion principle, when applied to parenting, involves watching and responding when you see your child being hard on himself. If you see your child punishing himself for his mistakes or being excessively angry with himself, it's time to step in and help. Point out that his anger at himself is excessive and misplaced. Even if it doesn't seem to help him in the moment, it will plant a seed in the back of his mind that will grow. Then use your self-soothing skills to comfort your child so that he can internalize them. The third self-compassion principle is to give your child the benefit of your wisdom and compassion. In order for your child to learn to forgive herself, she must experience forgiveness from you. She will internalize the level of harshness that you deliver to her. This encapsulates both of the previous principles because it involves responding to your child's mistakes by appropriately holding her responsible, intervening when you see her being too harsh on herself, helping her understand her mistake and the situation, and, in the end, forgiving her. When you do all of these things for her, she'll learn to do them for herself. Helping your child develop an inner, loving but firm voice, the fourth self-compassion principle, is vital to helping her have compassion for herself. Remember the example given in Chapter 7 of the healthy internal voice to use after running out of gas? That's a good template to use for your children as well. In the role of parent, talk through what happened and why, and help her determine for herself where she went wrong. Then reassure her that the point of making mistakes is to learn from them. Walk her through the process of understanding, owning, learning, and forgiving. This process is extremely valuable and will set your child up to be able to provide the support and accountability that's vital to being a successful and strong adult who has love and compassion for herself and others. 5. Guilt and shame versus healthy self-acceptance. Remember what causes guilt and shame in the emotionally neglected? It's the absence of parental acceptance and validation of the child's feelings, which eventually causes the child to feel that something is wrong with him for having emotions. Since everyone has emotions, the child may eventually become ashamed of this part of himself, trying to hide them from others and even from himself. What then, as a parent, can you do to make sure this doesn't happen for your child? Accept and validate his emotions, of course. As a parent who was emotionally neglected yourself, this may be more difficult than it sounds. It will require you to become more comfortable with emotions in general. You will need to be tolerant of what your child is feeling, even if you think your child's feelings are excessive or incorrect. Here are some suggestions for how to understand and accept your child's emotions. To illustrate this, let's think of your child's feelings as water flowing from him. If you put a barrier in front of the flowing water, the water will have to go somewhere. It will go around or over the barrier, or eventually, if it has nowhere to go, it will reverse and head back toward the source, meaning your child will turn his emotions upon himself. No matter what, the water will flow somewhere. You cannot stop the flow of your child's feelings, so please don't try. In order to deal with flowing water, you have to let it flow while you go to the source. So when your child is feeling something, let his feelings flow while at the same time trying to get back to the original cause of the feeling. This may involve asking your child some questions to help you both understand, or thinking back to situations that might have caused or intensified these feelings. Watch out for the danger of letting your child's feelings flood himself and you. Although it's not advisable to try to stop your child's feelings, there is a time to step in to help him manage them. Stopping and helping to manage are not the same thing. It's the difference between big boys don't cry and let's figure out together what's going on here and what we can do about it. Keep in mind that your child's feelings are a basic part of him, rooted in his human anatomy. He must not get a message from you that he's not to have them, but he must learn from you that it's possible and necessary to manage them. Use the emotion management skills from Chapter 6 to help your child learn these essential skills. Use emotion management skills for yourself, and your child will also learn them by example. If you do your best to follow all of these principles, you'll teach your child the opposite of guilt and shame. You'll be giving him essential skills that he'll use in every area of his life. He'll get the message from you that his feelings are a normal, healthy part of his identity, that he should listen to what they're telling him, but that he is not at their mercy. As a result, he'll grow up accepting and even valuing this vital, connecting, and enriching part of himself. 6. Self-blame versus forgiving. Forgiving is the final stage of self-compassion. When your child makes a poor choice or mistake, you will use the compassion principles to help her understand what part of her mistake is herself, what part is someone else, and what part is the circumstances. Then you'll help her figure out how to correct her mistake and prevent it from happening again. Then you'll help her forgive herself and put it behind her. You will put all of this time and energy into your parenting because you have personal experience with what happened for you when your parents didn't. You realize from your own experience that if we don't move on from the many mistakes we'll make in our lifetime, we'll become stuck in them. If we don't forgive ourselves, our mistakes can become an unnecessarily large part of us. They can take over our sense of self and can even become who we are. You don't want your child to be defined by her mistakes, as perhaps you have been by yours. Teach her that final step, how to put that mistake behind her. Then her mistakes will stay in proportion to reality, and she'll be freed up to take appropriate risks in a healthy way while keeping her self-esteem and self-love intact. 7. Fatal flaw versus likable and lovable. You probably remember that the fatal flaw is a feeling of being damaged somehow. If you get to know me well enough, you won't like me. It runs rampant in the emotionally neglected because of the absence of positive affection and notice from their parents. I can't tell you how many emotionally neglected adults, when asked if they grew up feeling loved, will answer, "I always knew my parents loved me." Knowing is not feeling, and feeling is the key here. It is vital to make sure that your child not only knows but feels that you like and love her. Warm, caring hugs, laughter, and truly enjoying your child's personality all go a long way toward conveying that feeling to your child. I know this may sound like parenting 101, but this is one of those things that many emotionally neglected people grew up without enough of. And if it doesn't come naturally to you, you may have to cultivate it for the good of your child. To take it one step further, an essential step in preventing your child from carrying the fatal flaw is to deal with your own. The fatal flaw is one of those characteristics which seems to be transferred from parent to child almost by osmosis. It seeps through from the parent to the child unnoticed and unrealized, becoming a part of the child's identity just as it is of the parents. Because it's a complex and underground emotion, people seldom are aware that they have it, and they certainly can't put it into words. Instead, it's an ever-present feeling that drives many of their decisions and hangs over them like a black cloud. Remember Carrie in Chapter 3? But the bottom line is, if you don't feel this way about yourself, you won't have to worry about the osmosis factor. I hope that in listening to this section, it has been clear how much your feelings about yourself percolate through to your children. If you feel love for yourself, you have a much greater capacity for feeling love for your child. If you have a strong sense of self-worth, it will seep through to your child, who will also have self-worth.